Hello and welcome to Dialect for the week beginning Sunday the 24th of April. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Sophia Costa. This week, back in the 1960s, US President John F. Kennedy tried to reform the money system, and some believe he was shot for his trouble. We look at the link between powerful private banking monopolies and what has become known as the global financial meltdown.
We also take a look at gangs and corruption, not in the city of London this time, but as part of Anthea Page's adventures in Guatemala in Central America.
Easter is what's known as a movable feast, based on full moons and such like, and it is a pagan festival as well. But what has Easter to do with the story of Moses, and what are its Judeo-Christian origins?
Plus the first episode of our new serial, Treasure Island, read by Malcolm Grieve.
And we have an exclusive royal wedding poem by Lisa Braden.
Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2. We're also broadcast on Preston FM, hello to you, and in St Albans on Radio Value Lamb.
If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen Square. Details are at the end of the show.
Easter is a festival based around the crucifixion of Jesus in Jerusalem. That took place on the Jewish Passover, so Easter is based on the Passover. But what is Passover? Tony Gosling reads us a piece on the topic from the website alongtimeago.com.
In ancient Egypt, more than 3,000 years ago, ruled the pharaoh Ramesses II. Under him, the land of Egypt prospered, for he was a strong and powerful ruler. One of Pharaoh's closest friends and advisers was Moses, a foundling, who'd been brought up in the royal court by one of the princesses as her own son. But Moses was a Hebrew, not an Egyptian, and his people were slaves under Ramesses. One day, Moses saw an Egyptian taskmaster beating a Hebrew slave, and he was so angry that he killed the Egyptian. Moses then fled to Midian, where he lived for many years as a shepherd. One day, while tending his flock, Moses saw a burning bush. The bush burnt fiercely but remained unharmed, and Moses understood that God, Yahweh, the Lord of Israel, was calling him to deliver his people, the Hebrews, from slavery in Egypt. Aaron, his brother, was to be his spokesperson, but Moses was to be Yahweh's special representative. Moses wondered how he would help his people out of Egypt, but God promised Moses he would help him. Moses and Aaron then returned to Egypt and told the Pharaoh of God's wish and command that he let the Hebrews go. But Ramesses refused, for he did not recognize their God, their Yahweh. Moses then performed a miracle to convince Ramesses of God's power. Aaron threw his staff upon the ground, and the staff turned into a snake. But Ramesses remained unconvinced and refused to let the Hebrews go. Next morning, as Pharaoh was walking by the River Nile, Moses and Aaron again asked him to let their people go. When Ramesses refused, Aaron struck the Nile with his staff and turned the river into blood, so no one could drink from it. But Ramesses remained unconvinced and still refused to let the Hebrews go free. God then sent the 9 plagues to Egypt, each worse than the one before. With every plague, Ramesses would be afraid and promise to let the Hebrews go. But as soon as God would lift the plague, he would go back to his word, and refused the Hebrews their freedom once again. Then God sent one final terrible plague to the land of Egypt. He sent his angel of death to visit every single household and take away the firstborn child. But Moses had warned the Hebrews and told them to mark their doors with a special sign. So that night, when the angel of death came to Egypt, he passed over the houses with the special sign and spared the firstborn of the Hebrews. So that was the first Passover, the Jewish festival that celebrates the passing over of the angel of death and the sparing of the firstborn of the Israelites. But the angel of death did not spare a single Egyptian family that night, and even took Pharaoh's son. In despair, the Pharaoh told Moses to take his people and leave Egypt forever.
Thank you very much to Tony Gosling.
Bill Steele's 2009 film, The Secret of Oz, which you can either buy or watch on YouTube, looks at the symbolism in The Wizard of Oz. In the film, Bill goes back to the Roman Jerusalem, to the Temple of Solomon, to look and discovers why Jesus was so annoyed by what the money changers were up to. As it turns out, there are big lessons for today's economists.
So let's take a journey down the yellow brick road through monetary history. Our first stop will be Rome. The problem with money is that, like many other things in life, people fight over who gets to be in control of it. In fact, the only time Jesus became violent was when he chased the money changers from the temple. He made a whip out of cords, and he scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. What was that all about? The money changers were the bankers of that day. they had created a special silver coin called the half shekel of the sanctuary. Even the poor had to have some of these coins to pay their temple tax, so the money changers could charge whatever the market would bear. This monopoly on money was nothing less than stealing from the poorest Jews on their holiest ground. This outraged Jesus just as it would outrage the senators of the Roman Republic a few years later. Although we will never know for sure, fighting over control of money may have been the cause of one of the most famous assassinations in history. What made Rome great? There were many factors, but certainly the most overlooked was the money system of the Roman Republic. About 300 BC, the Roman Republic supplied the people with a plentiful form of cheap money, money made from copper and bronze. Then they spent this cheap money into the economy. It was a revolutionary idea. Today, opponents of this money system call it fiat money, money not backed by precious metals. But what the Roman Republicans had discovered was that it doesn't matter what backs the money. All that matters is who controls its quantity. Did it work back then? It was amazingly effective. Unlike today, it was a money system created without debt to the government. This was the first great experiment in wresting the money power from the goldsmiths. This cheap form of money circulated for the benefit of all citizens equally, not just the usual gold coins, which always benefit the rich. With this new, plentiful supply of money, real wealth flowed to the common man.
Without the use of either gold or silver, Rome became mistress of commerce of the world. Her people were the bravest, the most prosperous, the most happy, for they knew no grinding poverty. Her money was issued directly to the people and was composed of a cheap material, copper and brass, based alone upon the faith and credit of the nation. With this abundant money supply, she built her magnificent courts and temples. She distributed her lands among the people in small holdings, and wealth poured into the coffers of Rome.
That was Bill Still with an extract from The Secret of Oz.
In this interview, we hear about problems facing Guatemala today as a direct legacy of long civil wars in the area, which have lasted 36 years. During the era of the civil wars, many orphans were taken by guerrillas. When civil wars finally ended, these young men went to America to find the American dream. Spurned by their fellow countrymen in the USA, they formed themselves into gangs, notably in Los Angeles, where they were known as the Maras. The American government, because of the violence perpetrated by these gangs, eventually sent them back to Central America, where the gangs, mainly in the big cities, formed themselves into no-go zones, usually called after the number of streets where they had lived in Los Angeles, for example, Maras 18 or Maras 12. In this interview, we hear from a Guatemalan about the legacy of a country suffering after effects of a long civil war, violence, corruption and poverty. This interview was recorded in Tikal, which is spelled T-I-K-A-L, in eastern Guatemala near the Belize border. The intro music you hear is called Danza de los Guatemalas from the CD El Pabanc.
Ricardo.
Could you tell us a bit about growing up in the era of the civil war in Guatemala?
Well, we heard a civil war was going on. We had lots of soldiers always on the road stops, you know, checking for your papers and giving you a hard time. We heard of many communities that were genocide by the militia in those days. But at the same time, we had two other countries in Central America that were going through the same. This was, one was San Salvador, or Salvador, and the other one was Nicaragua. Nicaragua, that revolution was triumphant, and nowadays we can see that what was believed to be a communist country is not at all a communist country. They're democratical, and they're trying to prosper as a country in San Salvador, or Salvador. Their revolution never got through like ours, even ours didn't. But they're the most well-off country of Central America. San Salvadorians are very hard-working people. They know about business. What I can say about what went on after the war in San Salvador, many of the San Salvadorian people went to the United States, where they were mistreated by other Latin groups and by the North American people. And since they were put into jail and they were very weak, they became to be the gangbangers that we know nowadays as the Salvatruchas and La Mara 18. So many of these people, I know their economical and social condition, and these are people that are not willing to follow the way that the social and economical way that their families lived, their fathers and grandfathers lived, because the wages in Central America are they're wages of hunger, of starvation. So the only way that how they can become strong is by uniting themselves. The gangs are actually armies. They recruit other young women and boys, girls and boys. They want to be heard. They want to be known. I think that there hasn't been an approach. The first thing that they're claiming for is justice, in all the sense of the word. Second place is equal opportunity. And these are things that up to today you can't see in these countries. So I do not support what they do, but I understand why they feel this way, why they have so much anger, so much hate. And the reason is because they've seen their mother suffer the alcoholism of his father, because his father knows that he's never going to be able to raise his children in a decent way. So the only way that he has escaped is through liquor. When his sister or his father's daughter goes to work, the most certain thing is that she's going to be abused by whomever she's going to work for. The next thing we know, she's going to be pregnant. And this type of situations have frustrated the youth of these countries. And this is what has pushed them over to become what we know nowadays known as mareros. You know, I've met some of these boys and girls, and they're pure-hearted. They're very strong. Sometimes they don't really know what they're doing. But what they're really doing is calling out for the world to really pay attention to what's going on in Central America. I think that probably we're not the only exception in the world. I think that there's many other youth all over the world that is screaming out, but we just can't hear them. And I think that the equal opportunities, the raising of the minimum wage, the chance to go to school, the chance of having tube water, electricity, and health is what they're actually claiming for.
Do you think the rest of the world is oblivious to what's going on in Central America?
I think that they have their own problems, and that's why they can't really take care of somebody else's problems. But there are international institutions that should really look into this. You know, there are people that I call them the coffee and tea people, that they're always sitting down at tables discussing how they're going to help people, and they're actually just spending the money that's given on grants and, you know, by people that give donations so they can aid countries like Guatemala, San Salvador, and not the country itself, but the youth of these countries.
What would you recommend then to stop this growing problem?
Well, in the first place, you know, I think that it's necessary an approach by people that care. Give them the means to approach the youth of Guatemala. Put rehabilitation centers, not where the youth are abused even worse than in the streets, but rehabilitation centers where they are taken accounted for like human beings, and people that's professionalized on talking, psychologists, people that really, like I said a few words ago, that really care about what's happening to them. You see what happens? Most of the donations go to the wrong places. So just because you do not belong to an NGO or you do not belong to the government, you do not qualify to be part of lots of these programs. So I think that if they really look hard enough, there are lots of people out there that have suffered the consequences because they have lots of probably nieces or sons of friends, that are just out there and that need to be reached. So I think that, like, even with reforestation and many other programs which are beneficial to the world, you know, I think that if somebody's going to be giving economical help, they should put it in the right pockets or in the right hands.
So why doesn't the government do this?
Because precisely the government's part of the problem. When you want to become rich in countries like my country, you become a politician or you get a job in the government. Instead of helping your people, you help yourself, and this has become a vice. We have people that you will not believe what they do in order to attract attention in Guatemala, to cheat people from their boat. There's this guy called Manuel Valdizón, who's a crook. Everybody thinks he's a beneficiary of the people because he approved a law for the people of the third age. This law was already in the Congress. What happens, like many other good laws, were not promoted. So he saw political opportunity on it, and he got this law promoted, which is good. You know, that's one of the probably the only good thing he has done in his 8 years of career. But what I'm saying is that the problem is our government. If somebody, we had, for example, help from international governments, from the government of Spain, in order to help clear out the impunity in Guatemala. Just yesterday, they killed one of the main judges from Santa Elena, from San Benito, walking in the street. And what happens is that when you look at policemen, sometimes you think they would be better off on the hands of the people who are going to mug you instead of the hands of the policemen. And this is sad, you know. When you see a policeman stopping you on the road, you already have a 100 quetzal bill on your hand. That's the only way you're going to get through in most of the occasions. But the main point is that we need new leaders in Guatemala. We need fresh blood. We need many of the congressmen have been there for 20, 15, 16 years. And they're the ones who make laws. They sell their votes on the Congress for new laws to pass, the loss of weapons, the loss of munition, alcohol and tobacco laws, and the laws that have to be that are necessary. For example, we had a donation of $17.5 million. To help people with medicine that have AIDS and that have tuberculosis and chronic malaria. And the party of this guy, Manuel Valdizón, did not allow the donation because they were not getting nothing under the table. So, and he is a young politician in Guatemala. So what I'm talking about is that we need new politicians, probably not politicians, but people that love their country and love their people. Most of us are not willing to do it because we know it's very corrupt. But more and more people... Nowadays that we're having the IRS of Guatemala, which is the taxation committee of Guatemala, taxing people, I hope that this will make people come out to the streets since we're paying taxes and demand that changes are done in are starting to be done in Guatemala. There's many issues about this subject, but it starts with our people that has the lowest expectation, the lowest chance to educate their families. There is where it should be. The efforts should be put on to, you know. Once I think that the people, the commoners, have a better life, I think that the country of Guatemala and the Central American countries have a better chance to make it out in this new era of the communication. I mean, everybody knows about internet. Everybody has cable TV nowadays, even in the most remote areas of Guatemala. And telephones. Telephones, the cell telephones are such a great thing when you use them in the right way, you know. And I just think, you know, I have hopes for Guatemala. And up to today, you know, I just wanted to let you know what my point of view of what happened with these guys, the gangbangers, you know. And they have kind of gave up their life. I mean, they put tattoos on their faces and the number 666 because they feel there's not other way to be noticed. And this is what's happening in these three countries that I know so.
Thank you very much to Anthea Page for her efforts there. That was an interview from Tikal in eastern Guatemala.
Treasure Island is an adventure novel by Scottish author Robert Louis Stevenson, narrating a tale of pirates and the buried gold. First published as a book on the 23rd of May, 1883, it was originally serialised in the children's magazine Young Folks between 1881 and 82. You are now going to hear the first instalment by Malcolm Grieve.
Thank you. Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 1, The Old Buccaneer. Chapter 1, The Old Sea Dog at the Admiral Benbow. Squire Trelawney, Dr. Livesey and the rest of these gentlemen, having asked me to write down the whole particulars about Treasure Island, from the beginning to the end, keeping nothing back but the bearings of the island, and that only because there is still treasure not yet lifted, I take up my pen and go back to the time when my father ran the Admiral Benbow Inn, and the brown old seaman with the sabre cut first took up his lodging under our roof. I remember him as if it were yesterday, as he came plodding to the inn door, his sea chest following behind him in a handbarrow. A tall, strong, heavy nut-brown man, his tarry pigtail falling over the shoulders of his soiled blue coat, his hands ragged and scarred with black broken nails, and the sabre cut across one cheek, a dirty, livid white. I remember him looking round the cove and whistling to himself as he did so, and then breaking out into that old sea song that he sang so often afterwards. 15 men on a dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum. In the high old tottering voice that seemed to have been turned and broken at the capstan bars. Then he rapped on the door with a bit of stick like a handspike that he carried, and when my father appeared, called roughly for a glass of rum. This, when it was brought to him, he drank slowly like a connoisseur, lingering on the taste, and still looking about him at the cliffs and up at our signboard. "This is a handy cove," says he at length, "and a pleasant city 80 grog shop." "Much company, mate?" My father told him no. Very little company, the more was the pity. "Well then," said he, "this is the berth for me." "Here you, matey," he cried to the man who trundled the barrow. "Bring up alongside and help up my chest." "I'll stay here a bit," he continued. "I'm a plain man. Rum and bacon and eggs is what I want, and that head up there for to watch ships off. What you mought call me?" "You mought call me Captain." "Oh, I see what you're at. Here," and he threw down 3 or 4 gold pieces on the threshold. "You can tell me when I've worked through that," says he, looking as fierce as a commander. And indeed, bad as his clothes were and coarsely as he spoke, he had none of the appearance of a man who sailed before the mast, but seemed like a mate or skipper, accustomed to be obeyed or to strike. The man who came with the barrow told us the mail had set him down the morning before at the Royal George, that he had inquired what inns there were along the coast, and hearing ours well spoken of, I suppose, and described as lonely, had chosen it from the others for his place of residence. And that was all we could learn of our guest. He was a very silent man by custom. All day he hung around the cove or upon the cliffs with a brass telescope. All evening he sat in a corner of the parlour next to fire and drank rum and water very strong. Mostly he would not speak when spoken to, only look up, sudden and fierce, and blow through his nose like a foghorn. And we and the people who came about our house soon learned to let him be. Every day, when he came back from his stroll, he would ask if any seafaring men had gone by along the road. At first we thought it was the want of company of his own kind that made him ask this question, but at last we began to see that he was desirous to avoid them. When a seaman put up at the Admiral Benbow, as now and then some did, making by the coast road for Bristol, he would look in at him through the curtained door before he entered the parlour, and he was always sure to be as silent as a mouse when any such was present. For me, at least, there was no secret about the matter, for I was in a way a sharer in his alarms. He had taken me aside one day and promised me a silver fourpenny on the first of every month if I would only keep my weather eye open for a seafaring man with one leg. I let him know the moment he appeared. Often enough, when the first of the month came round and I applied to him for my wage, he would only blow through his nose at me and stare me down. But before the end of the week, he was sure to think better of it, bring me my fourpenny piece, and repeat his orders to look out for the seafaring man with one leg. How that personage haunted my dreams, I need scarcely tell you. On stormy nights, when the wind shook the four corners of the house and the surf roared along the cove and up the cliffs, I would see him in a thousand forms and with a thousand diabolical expressions. Now the leg would be cut off at the knee, now at the hip. Now he was a monstrous kind of a creature who had never had but the one leg, and that in the middle of his body. To see him leap and run and pursue me over hedge and ditch was the worst of nightmares. And altogether I paid pretty dear for my monthly fourpenny piece, in the shape of these abominable fancies. But though I was so terrified by the idea of the seafaring man with one leg, I was far less afraid of the captain himself than anybody else who knew him. There were nights when he took a deal more rum and water than his head would carry, and then he would sometimes sit and sing his wicked old wild sea songs, minding nobody. But sometimes he would call for glasses round and force all the trembling company to listen to his stories or bear a chorus to his singing. Often I have heard the house shaking with yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum, all the neighbours joining in for dear life with the fear of death upon them, and each singing louder than the other to avoid remark. For in these fits he was the most overriding companion ever known. He would slap his hand on the table for silence all round. He would fly up in a passion of anger at a question, or sometimes because none was put, and so he judged the company was not following his story. Nor would he allow anyone to leave the inn until he had drunk himself sleepy and reeled off to bed. His stories were what frightened people worst of all. Dreadful stories they were, about hanging and walking the plank, and storms at sea, and the dry Tortugas, and wild deeds and places on the Spanish Main. By his own account, he must have lived his life amongst some of the wickedest men that God ever allowed upon the sea. And the language in which he told these stories shocked our plain country people.
That was the first instalment of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson, read by Malcolm Grave.
The capabilities of most weapons are pretty well understood, but when it comes to atomic explosions, the guessing game starts. All right, let's take a few minutes right now and get acquainted with an A-bomb. Needs test able.
A submarine bomb exploded in a harbor might affect a city. The affected area would be a poor picnic site, but might be entered briefly, a pass-through quickly, with a varying degree of risk. Some of the falsehoods circulated about radiation effects are trivial, but upsetting. Their beam right at one's self-esteem. Enough exposure to radiation will cause loss of hair. The treatment, if you'd insist, would be symptomatic. A toupee. And the condition would only be temporary. Your hair would come back. Same color.
Bomb explodes right then. It's a bomb. Duck and cover. Here's Tony going to his Cub Scout meeting. Tony knows the bomb can explode any time of the year, day or night.
Dusk and cover.
Atta boy, Tony. That flash means act fast. You and I don't have shells to crawl into like Bert the Turtle, so we have to cover up in our own way.
Paul and Patty know this.
No matter where they go or what they do, they always try to remember what to do if the atom bomb explodes right then. It's a bomb, dusk and cover. Here's Tony going to his Cub Scout meeting. Tony knows the bomb can explode any time of the year, day or night. Dusk and cover. Atta boy, Tony. That flash means act fast.
Trouble, soldier. You look a little bit worried.
Well, I am, Chaplain. Just a little bit.
Actually, there's no need to be worried, as the Army has taken all of the necessary precautions to see that we're perfectly safe here. Sir, have you ever been out of one of these shops before?
Yes, I've had the opportunity to see a number of the atomic tests. I feel that as a chaplain, it is my responsibility to be with my men.
What's it like, Chaplain?
First of all, one sees a very, very bright light, followed by a shock wave, and then you hear the sound of the blast, and then it seems as though there's a minor earthquake. And then you look up and you see the fireball as it ascends up into the heaven. It's a wonderful sight to behold.
weapons are pretty well understood. But when it comes to atomic explosions, the guessing game starts. All right, let's take a few minutes right now and get acquainted with an A-bomb. Meet Test Able.
A submarine bomb exploded in a hangar might affect a city. The affected area would be a poor picnic site, but might be entered briefly or passed through quickly with a varying degree of risk. Some of the falsehoods circulated about radiation effects are trivial, but upsetting. They're being right at one's self-esteem. Enough exposure to radiation will cause loss of hair. The treatment, if you insist, would be symptomatic, a toupee. But the condition would only be temporary. Your hair would come back, same color, same height.
Much about the atom bomb if it were to kill you right out. What scares me is that awful gas that deforms you.
Yeah. That would be bad.
Yeah.
Eager-eared listeners will remember the name Lisa Braden. She has been a co-presenter on this show and has interviewed guests before. However, she's also a poet and teaches creative writing, and with a very royal occasion coming up, the royal wedding no less, she's written us a poem. So, Lisa Braden, take it away with the royal wedding poem.
Remember me from a few years ago. I've been asked to do a bit of coverage for the forthcoming nuptials, so I've written a little ditty. I'd like to share it with you. There's something going on this week. Get in the street and shout or tweet. Will has bagged himself a wife, so say down the aisle for life. I told my Sheridan not to fear. Mummy will always be here. I'm not going, but I've been invited. I'm going nautical. Don't get excited. Can't say that I'm not let down. Can you really see a crown upon such a follically challenged head to lay upon the marital bed? Camilla will be neighing, so I've decided not to go. Carol will be best at dark, wearing garments from Primark. I did invest in a highbrow hat, but the guest list has put paid to that. Decks, X's and a loads of chavs, navigating Christianity via their sat-navs. For me, the wedding was Chaz and Di, because no matter what Kate'll wear, she's hardly Miss Debonair. I predict a slow demise, all things regal will surmise, a nation fit for consumptive disaster as the royals feast on rapacious laughter. I can't say whether I'll be there on the 29th, as I say I have my gilt-edged invite, but I may do something nautical in honour of my late husband. I've been invited at head of the table at a big street party in Bath, where I will be inaugurated.
Thank you, Lisa. A terribly exciting poetry corner this week. We have the Bard of Windmill Hill, as he is often on the show, Trevor Carser, but it's more exciting this week because he has a new book out.
Wow!
From Windmill Hill Publishing.
Wow!
How long has this been in the making?
Well, it's been in the making for the last few months, in particular.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's called Children of the Fire. That's the title of a Dennis Wheatley novel.
Well, there's no copyright on titles, really.
Okay, it's so, nothing to do with the dark arts.
It's not to do with the dark arts. Yeah. I should
is this
make
Children
that,
of the Creative Fire?
Yes, that's it. That's closer to it. Okay. Fire meaning to live a passionate and fulfilled life.
You are polite.
To be a child of the fire.
Okay, you are polite on the outside, but passion stir within.
Passion, it's about passion, yes.
Okay. Is there a common theme all the way through the book, particularly?
Yes, fire in the sense of life force, you know.
Okay.
That's kind of the idea of it, really. Okay. To live life with ever greater intensity.
So the Criminal Garden average dialect listener will no doubt know your name and your poetry. Where can people find this glorious tome?
Come and knock on my door.
Right, okay.
Yes, I haven't actually got it into any shops yet, although I will do.
Okay.
But in the meantime, just send me checks.
Send you checks?
Send me checks.
Well, irrespective of whether they get
to,
a book or not. Just send him checks anyway.
3 Somerset Terrace.
3 Somerset Terrace.
Windmill Hill. BS34LL, a cheque for £8, and that will secure you a copy in the post. I mean, if you're local, just come and knock on my door, you know.
Okay, right, well, 3 fine. Somerset Terrace, come to Bristol.
Or come and accost me at the Bristol Folk Festival on the 29th of this month.
Yes.
And the 1st of May, I'll be there both those days doing performances.
At the Colston Hall?
Yes. 29th is a film show with accompanying readings. And on the first, I'll be organising a folk slam cabaret on the Sunday afternoon. So you can find me there and stay on the Fred Wedlock stage.
Okay. Would you care to read us a poem from your wonderful new book?
Well, there's so much to choose from. I mean, okay, this is the title poem, all right?
Okay.
There is a lot of sort of cabaret poems and humour, you know, because I do a lot of light entertainments and all sorts of things. So. But this is the title poem, and it's called Children of the Fire. We are all children of the fire, evolved from life force underground. We are all driven by desire. We should all walk the highest wire to demonstrate we can't be bound. We are all children of the fire. We were not born to stint or tire until entombed by our death mound. We should be driven by desire. Who contradicts, I call a liar. Life should be bold and thought profound. We are all children of the fire. Do not languish in the mire. Go where passion can be found and be the servant of desire. Grasp at all that you require. Do not remain on safer ground. We are all children of the fire, born to serve our heart's desire.
Trevor Carter, thank you very much, and congratulations.
Thank you, John.
Well, according to his attire, he's on day release from HM Prison Dartmoor, so we better hurry up. Jeff's Box, what's on this week?
Thank you, John. Hello, this is What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting on Friday 29th of April until Sunday 8th of May, it's the North Somerset Arts Week. Over 300 artists will open their homes and studios or join together to exhibit their work in various venues throughout North Somerset. For further details, list of artists and a map of venues, you can check out www.northsomersetarts.org.uk. On Saturday 30th of April, Dr. Feelgood will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £12 in advance and £15 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Dragon's Fly. This group formed in 1997 and to date have released 3 albums. This is from their debut album, Dragon's Fly, and it's a song titled Pot and Shed Pixies. We'll be right back.
as your seas. When the big people are away, the Pixies will play.
That was Dragonsfly with the song Potting Shed Pixies from the album Dragonsfly. For more information on them, check out www.dragonsfly.org. On Friday 29th of April until Sunday 1st of May, it is the Bristol Folk Festival at Colston Hall in Colston Street, Bristol. Headlining on Friday is Seth Lakeman. Saturday headliners are Show of Hands. And on Sunday it's Bellowhead headlining. Also, there will be workshops, Morris dancing, poetry and performances from acts such as Three Daft Monkeys, Port Isaac's Fisherman's Friends, Phil King, Jacanda and Keith Warrington. An adult weekend ticket costs £75 and for children, students and over 65s, it's £65. Day tickets are £30 for Friday, £40 for Saturday and £45 for Sunday. For the full lineup and other information, you can check out www.bristolfolkfestival.com. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 12 noon every Sunday, and is broadcast on Preston FM and in St Albans on Radio Fairulam.
If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, and it will remind you every Thursday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Reporters this week were Anthony Page and Tony Gosling, and studio production was by Michael Norris. The producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to do so, please contact us on Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteer.org.uk. Next week, more Treasure Island. Well, that was Dialect. I'm Sophia Costa.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. We both wish you a very good week from all the team in our Queen's Square studio in Bristol. Thank you very much. Take care.
Punishment for your lack.